Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Foss is a Professor of Medical Oncology and Dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed welcomes Scott Capoza and Lou Friedman, two physical therapists who specialize in working with cancer patients. Scott sees his patients through the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic, and Lou focuses his time assisting orthopedic and breast cancer patients at Yale. Here's Ed Chu.
You know, let's just start off. You know, I think a lot of people don't really appreciate all the different types of resources that are available to one once the diagnosis of cancer is made and once cancer treatment is initiated. And perhaps, Lou, maybe you can start off by describing for us, you know, what role you see the physical therapist can play as part of that multidisciplinary approach to treating patients with cancer.
Certainly. Glad to answer that. And I think it depends on what point the first contact is made. I mean, Scott can see patients almost on a wellness issue, whereas they're coming in looking, they perhaps have a problem with a certain activity, they want to improve their activity, their lifestyle, exercise, and they're looking for some consultation and some guidance. In our outpatient clinic, we see patients who actually have problems. They might have problems with moving their shoulder or lymphedema. They actually have seen a physician. They have a medical diagnosis, and we're setting up a treatment plan for them. I would say one of the keys, whether it's in my clinic or when Scott gets them, is really education and guidance. A lot of patients are looking for answers. They're not quite sure what they can and can't do after a diagnosis of cancer and after their treatment, and I think one of the biggest roles we play is helping guide them through that process.
And I guess in your experience, Lou, and also maybe Scott, you can weigh in as well, you know, what are the main types of cancers for which physical therapy really seems to play an important role?
I can answer that. From our clinic, we see a wide variety. We see patients who have had breast cancer. They may have had surgery for their breast cancer, and it could be any combination of issues with problems with their shoulder, difficulty with activities of daily living. We see patients with lymphedema, which is a swelling of the arm. We also see individuals who've had ovarian and uterine cancer. They might have issues with their legs, also swelling in their legs or difficulty with their mobility, as well as individuals with head and neck cancer, difficulties moving their neck, moving their shoulders.
Okay. And Scott, what type of cancer patients do you see in your clinic?
We see patients who've had all types of cancer. Primarily, I would say we see breast cancer survivors, but we have seen survivors of leukemias and lymphomas, survivors of prostate cancer, colon cancer. And so what we do is when somebody comes in, as Lou was talking about, you know, I give them a lot of guidance as far as where they are and help them to design an exercise program, because a lot of people didn't exercise prior to their cancer diagnosis, and now they feel like they need to and they don't know how to start up. One of the other big side effects of cancer treatments that is very prevalent in cancer survivors is fatigue. And so I talk a lot with patients about how to kind of battle that fatigue and how to get through that so that they can start leading an active life. And if they come into our clinic and I notice that they do have limitations in their strength or their range of motion, especially for the breast cancer survivors, then I definitely make the referral to Lou and to the outpatient clinic so that they can get the more hands-on treatment that they need.
So Scott, in your clinic, which is the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic, are most of the patients, they've already completed their therapy and now kind of you're dealing with the consequences, the sequelae of either the cancer and or the cancer treatment?
Yeah, that's well put. We work with people who are done with their active treatments, so post-surgery, post-radiation, post-chemotherapy. For some of the women who are on hormone therapy or Herceptin, we do see them, and we can see a survivor from, you know, 6 to 8 weeks after they completed treatment all the way to, you know, 10 to 15, 20 years after they've completed treatment. So there really isn't a cap, so to speak, as to when we would see a survivor.
And Lou, in your clinic, it sounds like you actually see patients who may have been diagnosed right up front with their cancer and are undergoing active treatment. Is that correct?
We will see individuals that are currently undergoing radiation, currently undergoing treatment. So that does force us to modify our treatment plans according to their general endurance level. They may be fairly recently post-operative, so we have to, we can't push them too hard. Mm-hmm. So we really do have to adjust our treatment plan according to their individual needs.
I mean, it sounds like just kind of hearing the different types of symptoms that you two treat, that really almost any cancer patient, truthfully, right, once given the diagnosis, once undergoing active therapy, really could benefit from at least an initial consultation with a physical therapist.
I'd like to answer that just briefly. We are seeing that more and more. I believe that the patients themselves are advocating for themselves. The physicians are much more willing now not that they weren't willing, but it just wasn't let me back up just a little bit, and I think it comes to survivorship. The focus used to be on the diagnosis and survival. And with the advances in care, we're seeing many more survivors. And as a result of that, we're seeing patients that have, say, musculoskeletal issues that now they want to have addressed. They're concerned with the quality of their life having survived now. Mm-hmm. And so I think we are definitely seeing an influx, and we're seeing a willingness of the medical team all in all just to refer patients to our clinic so that the patients can move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my sense is, and I think as you may know, so my area of, I guess, interest has been in treatment of patients with colorectal cancer, and as now colon cancer, breast cancer, and many other cancers are becoming more of a chronic disease, chronic illness, and then kind of symptom management, maintaining quality of life really kind of come to the fore in terms of how we begin to approach patients.
Mm-hmm. That's very true, and I think when someone comes to our survivorship clinic, you're right, absolutely right. The whole idea of quality of life, and that it's not just enough to make it through their treatments, that once their treatments are done, people want to get back to their life. And we have kind of this idea of this new normal of what it's like to be a cancer survivor. And I know at our clinic, we also have a dietitian, a social worker, and a nurse practitioner to talk about all of those different areas of need of a survivor. So it's not just the physical, it's also the emotional, and it's the medical that needs to be maintained. And so many people have questions about their diet as well. So it's all rolled into one.
Mm-hmm. Now, Lou, in your clinic, one of the areas that you focus on is lymphedema. Maybe again, for the listeners out there, kind of a complicated word, maybe explain to us what lymphedema is.
Certainly, and it's somewhat of a complicated concept, but I'll simplify it. Essentially, lymphedema is a buildup of fluid in the body tissue where it doesn't belong. To understand that, Dr. Chu, obviously, the listeners need to understand fluid mechanics, and if I'll go briefly over that, is the heart pumps oxygen-rich fluid to all areas of the body, every nook and cranny. The issue then is getting it back to the heart. If all the fluid came out of the heart and didn't return, the person wouldn't survive that long. So it comes out one way, which is the arteries. It comes back two ways, which is the veins, and then here comes the lymphatic system. So whatever the veins don't bring back, it is the job of the lymphatic system to bring back. The lymphatic system has structures in it called lymph nodes. And the unfortunate part of these lymph nodes is that cancer tends to like lymph nodes. So when there is surgery, the surgeons have to look for cancer in the lymph nodes, and oftentimes has to remove the lymph nodes to get all the disease out of the body. What that does is it clogs up the return system, and that builds up fluid in the body tissues.
And are there specific types of cancer in which we see a higher incidence of lymphedema?
In our clinic, we see three main types. We see patients who have had surgery for breast cancer, so they would have lymphedema or swelling in the arm, the chest wall, and oftentimes the armpit. We see patients who've had ovarian cancer and uterine cancer, and lymph nodes have been taken out from the pelvic area. You may see a buildup of fluid in the legs. We also see a number of patients who've had head and neck cancer, and so they have what's called a neck dissection, and they take lymph nodes out of the head and neck area. That will cause fluid to build up in the neck area and the facial area.
Now, is there any way to predict which patient will or will not develop this buildup of fluid?
Unfortunately not. It's one of those things that has been tried. You know, we've tried to study. It's just very hard to study. I can tell you that there are some risk factors. In other words, if weight gain, a person needs to maintain their body weight. Infection is a risk factor. So by all means, a person needs to be able to not get an infection. They have to be very cautious about their skin care. I would say an injury, whether it be a traumatic injury or an overuse injury, those are some potential risk factors that could produce lymphedema in a body. But we don't really have an answer and say, you know, if you do X, Y, and Z, you won't get it. That doesn't exist.
And so once lymphedema is diagnosed and a patient suffers the consequences, the symptoms, they come to see you. So what are the different approaches that you will take to treat that process?
Right. Thank you. That's a good question. And it's a very global approach. We have to do a lot of different things because there really is no one thing that is the answer. And it's different for every person. We use a combination of techniques. One is called manual lymph drainage. It's a hands-on technique where we are trying to move the lymphatic fluid out of the area that's congested, if you will, with the fluid, and direct it back to the heart or around the area that is impaired. We will use certain types of compression, whether it be a compression garment or a wrap called a short stretch bandage. A lot of education, as we talked about, preventing infections. So the education over skin care, we do a lot of education on the appropriate type of exercise. Exercise is good for lymphedema, and over-exercise is not good for lymphedema. So education, as I mentioned earlier, seems to be a very important part of what we do.
Now, I know many, many years ago, there was like a machine that would try to kind of, I guess, pump out the fluid back into the circulation. Is that still being used at all, or is that kind of passé?
Well, we use it in very rare cases. I shouldn't say rare, but in a small number of cases. The original design of that pump was for venous insufficiency, and it works very well for venous insufficiency. People tried to convert it over to use for lymphedema, and one of the problems is that the pump really will move fluid. Lymphedema tends to be protein rich, and you have to do the hands-on care to open up those pathways. What will happen potentially with the pump is that you can move fluid out of the lower part of the leg but have it congested in the upper part of the limb, whether it be in the upper arm or in the upper part of the leg.
And are there any ways, new ways that you're aware of that we can begin to identify? You know, you mentioned the risk factors, but are there any new sophisticated technology that might be used to identify which patient will down the road develop lymphedema?
To the best of my knowledge, there isn't. There are some new machines that look at impedance, which is electrical flow, and they look to see if one arm has a higher impedance versus the other. To my knowledge, that hasn't proved effective yet. I don't know whether that's something that will eventually be of use.
So something just maybe for you to be aware of, Lou, is Dr. Susan Higgins in radiation oncology is about to open up a clinical study, actually, I guess, using one of these machines to measure the impedance values. And I guess it's in women with breast cancer, but I think she's now thinking of opening it up for patients with ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, and maybe even melanoma, because I guess they also may, if they have had a lymph node dissection, they may be at increased risk. So maybe something that perhaps we should get you and Dr. Higgins and her team hooked up together.
Certainly. Hopefully down the road that will show to be of value.
Yeah, so that actually should be quite interesting. I think actually what we'll do now is let's take a break for a medical minute. You're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and I'm here discussing the important role of supportive care and physical therapy for patients with cancer with Scott Capoza and Lou Friedman.
It's estimated that over 2 million men in the U.S. are currently living with prostate cancer. One in six American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to experimental medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Ed Chu, and I'm here in the studio this evening with Scott Capoza and Lou Friedman, both of whom are physical therapists at the Yale Cancer Center and the Yale New Haven Hospital. Scott, why don't we have a discussion about the role of exercise and physical fitness and kind of where that fits into kind of treating patients with cancer?
Well, I think exercise and fitness fits in with cancer patients throughout their treatment and the journey into survivorship as well. The patient who is able to do a little bit of exercise during their treatments might actually find that they recover a little bit quicker from their treatments. And I think it helps them also from a mental standpoint too. One of the tough things about being a cancer patient is you kind of lose control of what's going on in your life. And so for a cancer patient to at least be able to take control of that and say, you know what, I'm still going to go out and I'm going to try to go for a 20-minute or a 30-minute walk or something to that line, then I think that empowers the patient a little bit more, and I think it helps them mentally as well as physically to get through their treatment. And then as the cancer patient makes that transition into cancer survivor post-treatment, it's very important to continue with exercise and fitness, because you want to be able to reduce your risk of a reoccurrence and try to get back to the way your life was and help get rid of some of those side effects from the chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. It helps with circulation and overall body healing, maintaining your weight, which are all very important things to do. So that's why exercise is such an important part of the cancer process.
So it's interesting that you mentioned that being physically active and a cancer patient, you know, doing exercise really has a positive impact on ultimate prognosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I guess it really is an important issue for our listeners out there to take home.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, as cancer patients can attest, you know, there are going to be some days where the cumulative effects of chemotherapy will catch up to them, or the cumulative effects of radiation will catch up to them, and there will be some days where, you know, you really won't be able to exercise, or based on the surgery that you had, or if your blood levels are really low, you know, that's a conversation that the patient has to have with their doctor about, is exercise safe and that sort of thing. But if your doctor gives you the green light to say, yeah, you're okay to do some form of exercise, then again, I think it helps with the body healing itself from the surgeries and from radiation and from chemotherapy, and then also, like I said, the mental aspect of it as well.
And Scott, maybe you can help our listeners with respect to, you know, what type of physical exercise, you know, are we talking about? Is it really kind of strenuous exercise that you'd see people, you know, out in the gyms, you know, runners, or, you know, maybe kind of quantitate that a little bit for us?
Right. For most cancer survivors, some form of exercise, really the gold standard is to try to do something 5 times a week. And so if that's walking at a good clip, so you know, you're walking at a pace where you are able to elevate your heart rate and maintain that elevated heart rate, then that's good. You could also do biking, you could do swimming, you could do some running. We don't necessarily need to have people go out and train for the Ironman triathlon or for a marathon, you know, to that extent. But a combination of the cardiovascular work is really good, and also a little bit of strength training as well, especially for some of the women who are put on some of the hormone therapies that puts them at risk for osteopenia and osteoporosis. They want to maintain good bone strength. So weight-bearing activities, again, like walking are good, and then strength training with the upper body is good to help maintain that bone density to help them as they go through.
Now, how about in the case where, you know, a patient is undergoing active chemotherapy? And as I think you had mentioned earlier, that a lot of those patients will experience fatigue. Mm-hmm. So how do you kind of get them to do, again, not maybe the strenuous exercise, but mm-hmm. to do some form of exercise?
Right. I think with when patients are going through chemotherapy, they'll figure out during their cycle when their good days are going to be and when their not so good days are going to be, you know, when those cumulative effects do catch up. And so I think on those days where they know that they're going to be feeling okay, that maybe it's as simple as, you know, writing it down in their daily planner. You know, if you're one of those types of people who, you know, writes everything down in your planner or your BlackBerry or iPod or whatever it might be. And so if you write it down, then it holds you a little bit more accountable to go out and exercise if it's just a 20 or 30 minute walk. Maybe it's contacting a friend or a family member, a neighbor, to say, hey, you know what, I really need to go for a walk today, but I really need your help. I need your encouragement to help me get out the door. So, you know, let's set a time. Let's meet at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock and let's go do that. So eliciting the support of family and friends is a really good way to also kind of keep you honest and try to help you stay on task with that.
And again, these recommendations should really hold for everyone who has a diagnosis of cancer, because I'm sure there are probably some listeners out there who have cancer, have finished their treatments, probably weren't very active to begin with, mm-hmm. and now are saying, how can I kind of become physically fit and exercise like you're suggesting?
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest things that I see at our survivorship clinic is people who did not exercise prior to their cancer diagnosis, and then they go through their treatments and they realize that, you know what, I don't want to go through this again, and I want to be able to prevent a reoccurrence, and I just want to get back to as normal of a life as possible. And so they realize that exercise and nutrition are such important components of that, but they don't know how because they didn't have that experience previously. So that's one of the things that we can do at this fascial clinic is kind of give them some counseling and help design an exercise program for them so that it helps them move forward from there.
Now, Scott, you have a very interesting perspective because you're a cancer survivor.
I am.
And as I understand it, you've now hit the 10-year mark.
Mm-hmm.
So congratulations.
Thank you.
That really is a tremendous accomplishment. So you have a very interesting perspective, one as a cancer survivor, but also as a physical therapist. Maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I was diagnosed with cancer when I was 22 and I was in graduate school for physical therapy school, actually. And I was actually a runner previously. I ran competitively cross country and track in high school and college. So I did exercise previously to my cancer diagnosis. And so when I was diagnosed, it really took me by surprise because I didn't think that I would ever get cancer because I ran so much. And I remember after surgery, my doctor said, you know, you can't run for 6 weeks afterwards. You know, you need to allow your body to heal. And I unfortunately didn't listen to him. I started running after 4 weeks. And I remember during my first consultation with my oncologist for chemotherapy, he sat me down and he talked to me about, you know, these are the three drugs you're going to be on. You're going to lose your hair. You'll be nauseous. These are all the side effects. Do you have any questions? And my first question to him was, can I still run? And I don't think a lot of patients had asked him that question before because the look on his face was kind of, you know, I think I took him by surprise. But I knew for me, physically I needed to do it in order to, like I said, in order to heal and maintain that normalcy that was part of my life. And I knew I needed to do it mentally too because I needed to prove to myself that I wasn't losing the fight against cancer. And so I think I've taken that perspective and I've tried to bring it to my patients at the survivorship clinic too to tell them that, listen, anybody can do this on some level. It does, like I said, you don't have to be a marathon runner. You don't have to go out and, you know, bike 100 miles every single day. But to be able to do something empowers you as you get through your battle with cancer.
Great, terrific. And again, as you've mentioned, you're a key member of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic. And in that clinic, as you say, patients will see kind of different individuals, nutritionists, exercise physiologists, physical therapists, yourself, social workers, physician, and at the end of that visit, a treatment summary is prepared. And tell us what goes into that treatment summary.
What goes into the treatment summary is all four of the disciplines, the nurse practitioner, the social worker, the dietitian, and myself, we write up our narratives, we write up our plan of care, so to speak, and it's all formulated together into one document, which is then sent to the patient, and can also be sent to any and all of the patient's physicians, primary care physician, oncologist, radiation oncologist, whoever the patient wants us to send that information to. And so that's a hard copy that the patient can have, and it's a nice little review of what we talked about. Then as part of our clinic, we have a 2-month follow-up and a 4-month follow-up. So it gives us an opportunity to check back in with the survivor and the survivor to check back in with us to say, hey, you know, 2 months ago we talked about, you know, starting a walking plan and, you know, going to the gym once or twice a week. How's that going? Is that going good? Is that not going good? You know, and then we can brainstorm on further ideas to help them through.
Great. Now, maybe let's get Lou back in here. I think, you know, one of the complaints that I hear quite frequently from our cancer patients is back pain. And that could either be because of the cancer or because of benign causes. And I'm just curious, you know, how do each of you approach patients with back pain, and what are kind of the general approaches that you take to try to help to relieve that symptom?
Well, that's interesting. In my role treating orthopedic patients, we see a lot of back pain, and I actually have not seen a lot of individuals in my clinic with back pain related to cancer diagnoses. I can answer that a little bit just from a general back pain perspective. And back pain is one of those things that really fits into what we've been talking about here today. And one of the keys for back pain is exercise. Looking at the right amount of flexibility in the body, the right amount of strength of the abdominal muscles, tightness of the legs and hips certainly can produce back pain. Oftentimes it's the postures that we maintain hours on end without reversing that posture. So I would imagine that from that perspective, if it's musculoskeletal, it would really fall into the same category as general orthopedic back pain.
But I have to say, I had disc disease many years ago, and the alternatives were either surgery or physical therapy. So needless to say, I opted for the intense physical therapy, and it was really quite remarkable how doing all of those various exercises that you just mentioned, probably within 2 months, actually, the back pain and the paresthesias disappeared.
I also, in my early 20s, hurt my back at work. And this was before I was a physical therapist. And lucky for me, I learned how to manage it on a conservative basis. I can tell you that if I go 4 or 5 days without doing my specific back exercises, my back will start to hurt. And if I can keep on it, I can keep it completely at bay and do just about anything I want to do.
Well, it's amazing how quickly the time has gone. We've got about 60 seconds. So, you know, what final piece of advice can you give to our listeners out there who would like to but need to kind of be urged to take that first step in becoming more active and kind of improving their overall health?
Well, I think that as you've gone through your cancer treatment and you're a survivor now, you know, you need to take a look at that opportunity to say, this is my second chance to really do something good here. And so if you are looking to get into a fitness program, that there are or to start up exercising, there are programs out there like our Survivorship Clinic to help you with that. If you do have more of the physical side effects from your treatment, such as lymphedema or scar tissue, limitations in range of motion, then that's a great opportunity for a physical therapist to work with you and really get their hands on you to help you through that.
Great. You've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and I'd like to thank our guests this evening, Scott Capoza and Lou Friedman, for joining me. From the Yale Cancer Center, this is Ed Chu wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.